everything is lost, she said. Everything is transformed. But then, said Bastian in alarm, I ought to hurry. I shouldn't be staying here. She stroked his hair. Don't worry. It will take time. But when your last wish is awakened, you'll know it. And so will I. From that day on, something began indeed to change, though Bastian himself noticed nothing at first. The transforming power of the House of Change was taking effect. But like all true transformations, it was as slow and gentle as the growth of a plant. The days in the House of Change passed, and it was still summer. Bastian still enjoyed letting Dame Iola spoil him like a child. Her fruit still tasted as delicious to him as at the start, but little by little his craving had been stilled. He ate less than before. Dame Iola noticed, though she never mentioned it. He also felt that he had had his fill of her care and tenderness, and as his need for them dwindled, a longing of a very different kind made itself felt, a desire that he had never felt before, and that was different in every way from all his previous wishes. The longing to be capable of loving. With surprise and dismay, he recognized that he could not love, and the wish became stronger and stronger. One evening, as they were sitting together, he spoke of it to Dame Iola. After listening to him, she said nothing for a long while. She looked at Bastian with an expression that puzzled him. Now you have found your last wish, she said finally. What you really and truly want is to love. But why can't I, Dame Iola? You won't be able to until you have drunk of the water of life, she said, and you can't go back to your own world unless you take some of it back for others. Bastian was bewildered. But what about you? He asked. Haven't you drunk of it? No, said Dame Iola. It's different for me. I only needed someone to whom I could give my excess. But isn't that love? Dame Iola pondered a while. Then she said, It was the effect of your wish. Can't Fantasticans love? Are they like me? He asked anxiously. She answered, There are some few creatures in Fantastica, so I'm told, who get to drink the water of life. But no one knows who they are. And there is a prophecy, which we seldom speak of, that sometime in the distant future, humans will bring love to Fantastica. Then the two worlds will be one. But what that means, I don't know. Dame Iola, Bastian asked, you promised that when the right moment came, you'd tell me what I had to forget to find my last wish. Has the time come? She nodded. You had to forget your father and mother. Now you have nothing left but your name. Bastian pondered. Father and mother? He said slowly. But the words had lost all meaning for him. He had forgotten. What must I do now? He asked. You must leave me. Your time in the House of Change is over. Where must I go? Your last wish will guide you. Don't lose it. Should I go now? No, it's late. Tomorrow, at daybreak. You have one more night in the House of Change. Now we must go to bed. Bastian stood up and went over to her. Only then, only when he was close to her, did he notice that all her flowers had faded. Don't let it worry you, she said, and don't worry about tomorrow morning. Go your way. Everything is just as it should be. Good night, my darling boy. Good night, Dame Iola, Bastian murmured. Then he went up to his room. When he came down the next day, he saw that Dame Iola was still in the same place. All her leaves, flowers, and fruits had fallen from her. Her eyes were closed, and she looked like a black, dead tree. For a long time, he stood there gazing at her. Then suddenly, a door opened. Before going out, he turned around once again and said, without knowing whether he was speaking to Dame Iola or to the house or both, "Thank you. Thank you for everything." Then he went out through the door. Winter had come overnight. The snow lay knee-deep, and nothing remained of the flowering rose garden but bare black thorn bushes. Not a breeze stirred. It was bitter cold, and very still. Bastian wanted to go back into the house for his mantle, but the doors and windows had vanished. It had closed itself up all around. Shivering, he started on his way. 25. The Picture Mine. Yor, the blind miner, was standing beside his hut, listening for sounds on the snow-covered plain around him. The silence was so complete that his sensitive hearing picked up the crunching of footsteps in the snow far in the distance, and he knew that the steps were coming his way. Yor was an old man, but his face was beardless and without a wrinkle. Everything about him, his dress, his face, his hair, was stone grey. As he stood there motionless, he seemed carved from congealed lava. Only his blind eyes were dark, and deep within them there was a glow, as of a small, bright flame. The steps were Bastian's. When he reached the hut, he said, "Good day. I've lost my way. I'm looking for the fountain the water of life springs from. Can you help me?" The miner replied in a whisper, "You haven't lost your way, but speak softly, or my pictures will crumble." He motioned to Bastian, who followed him into the hut. It consisted of a single, small, bare room. A wooden table, two chairs, a cot, and two or three wooden shelves piled with food and dishes were the only furnishings. A fire was burning on an open hearth, and over it hung a kettle of soup. Yor ladled out soup for himself and Bastian, put the bowls on the table, and with a motion of his hand invited his guest to eat. They ate in silence. When the miner leaned back, his eyes looked through Bastian and far into the distance as he asked in a whisper, "Who are you?" "My name is Bastian Balthazar Books." "Ah, so you still know your name." "Yes, and who are you?"
"I am Yor. People call me the Blind Miner, but I am blind only in the daylight. In the darkness of my mine, I can see."
"What sort of mine is it?"
"The Minrud Mine, they call it. It's a picture mine."
"A picture mine?" said Bastian in amazement. "I've never heard of such a thing." Yor seemed to be listening for something.
"And yet," he said, "it's here for just such as you. For humans who can't find the way to the water of life."
"What kind of pictures are they?" Bastian asked. Yor shut his eyes and was silent for a while. Bastian didn't know whether to repeat his question. Then he heard the miner whisper,
"Nothing gets lost in the world. Have you ever dreamed something, and when you woke up, not known what it was?"
"Yes," said Bastian, "often." Yor nodded. Then he stood up and beckoned Bastian to follow him. Before they left the hut, he dug his fingers into Bastian's shoulders and whispered, "But not a word, not a sound, understand? What you are going to see is my work of many years. The least sound can destroy it. So tread softly and don't talk." Bastian nodded and they left the hut. Behind it there was a wooden headframe, below which a shaft descended vertically into the earth. Passing these by, the miner led Bastian out into the snow-covered plain. And there, in the snow, lay the pictures, like jewels bedded in white silk. They were paper-thin sheets of colored, transparent isinglass of every size and shape, some round, some square, some damaged, some intact, some as large as church windows, others as small as snuffbox miniatures. They lay, arranged more or less according to size and shape, in rows extending to the snowy horizon. What these pictures represented, it was hard to say. There were figures in weird disguise that seemed to be flying through the air in an enormous bird's nest, donkeys in judges' robes, clocks as limp as soft butter, dressmakers' dummies standing in deserted, glaringly lighted squares. There were faces and heads pieced together from animals and others that made up a landscape. But there were also perfectly normal pictures, men mowing a wheat field, women sitting on a balcony, mountain villages and seascapes, battle scenes and circus scenes, streets and rooms, and many, many faces, old and young, wise and simple, fools and kings, cheerful and gloomy. There were gruesome pictures, executions and death dances, and there were comical ones, such as a group of young ladies riding a walrus, or a nose walking about and being greeted by passers-by. The longer Bastian looked at the pictures, the less he could make of them. He and Yor spent the whole day walking past row after row of them, and then dusk descended on the great snowfield. Bastian followed the miner back to the hut. After closing the door behind them, Yor asked in a soft voice, "Did you recognize any of them?"
"No,"
said Bastian. The miner shook his head thoughtfully.
"Why?" Bastian asked. "What are they?"
"They are forgotten dreams from the human world," Yor explained. "Once someone dreams a dream, it can't just drop out of existence. But if the dreamer can't remember it, what becomes of it? It lives on in Fantastica, deep under our earth. There the forgotten dreams are stored in many layers. The deeper one digs, the closer together they are. All Fantastica rests on a foundation of forgotten dreams."
Bastian was wide-eyed with wonderment.
"Are mine there too?" he asked.
Yor nodded.
"And you think I have to find them?"
"At least one," said Yor.
"One will be enough."
"But what for?"
Bastian wanted to know. Now the miner's face was lit only by the faint glow of the hearth fire. Again his blind eyes looked through Bastian and far into the distance.
"Listen to me, Bastian Balthazar Books," he said. "I'm no great talker. I prefer silence. But I will answer this one question. You are looking for the water of life. You want to be able to love. That's your only hope of getting back to your world. To love,
That's easily said. But the water of life will ask you, love whom? Because you can't just love in general. You've forgotten everything but your name. And if you can't answer, it won't let you drink. So you'll just have to find a forgotten dream, a picture that will guide you to the fountain. And to find that picture, you will have to forget the one thing you have left, yourself. And that takes hard, patient work. Remember what I've said, for I shall never say it again. After that, he lay down on his wooden cot and fell asleep. Bastian had to content himself with the hard, cold floor, but he didn't mind. When he woke up the next morning, feeling stiff in all his joints, Yor was gone. To the mine, no doubt, Bastian decided. He took a dish of the hot soup, which warmed him, but didn't taste very good. Too salty. It made him think of sweat and tears. Then he went out into the snow-covered plain and walked past the pictures. He examined one after another attentively, for now he knew how important it was, but he found none that meant anything in particular to him. Toward evening, Yor came up from the mine. Bastian saw him step out of the pit cage. In a frame on his back, he was carrying different-sized sheets of paper-thin isinglass. Bastian followed him in silence as he went far out into the plain and carefully bedded his new finds in the soft snow at the end of a row. One of the pictures represented a man whose chest was a birdcage with two pigeons in it, another a woman of stone riding on a large turtle. One very small picture showed a butterfly with letters on its wings, and many more. But none meant anything to Bastian. Back in the hut with the miner, he asked, "What will become of the pictures when the snow melts?" "It's always winter here," said Yor. They had no other conversation that evening. In the following days, Bastian kept searching among the pictures for one with some special meaning for him, but in vain. In the evening, he sat in the hut with the miner. Since the miner kept silent, Bastian got into the habit of saying nothing, and little by little he adopted Yor's careful way of moving, for fear of making the pictures crumble. "Now I've seen all the pictures," Bastian said one night. "None of them is for me." "That's bad," said Yor. "What should I do?" Bastian asked. "Should I wait for you to bring up new ones?" Yor thought it over. Then he shook his head. "If I were you," he whispered, "I'd go down into the mine and dig for myself." "But I haven't got your eyes," said Bastian. "I can't see in the dark." "Weren't you given a light for your long journey?" Yor asked, looking through Bastian. "A sparkling stone, or something that might help you now?" "Yes," said Bastian sadly, "but I used Altzahir for something else." "That's bad," Yor said again. "Then what do you advise?" Bastian asked. After a long silence, the miner replied, "Then you'll just have to work in the dark." Bastian shuddered. He still had all the strength and fearlessness Orin had given him, but the thought of crawling on his belly in the black underground darkness sent the shivers down his spine. He said nothing more, and they both lay down to sleep. The next morning, the miner shook him by the shoulders. Bastian sat up. "Eat your soup and come with me," said Yor. Bastian obeyed. He followed the miner to the shaft and got into the pit cage with him. Together, they rode down into the mine. At first, a faint beam of light followed them down the shaft, but it vanished as the cage went deeper. Then a jolt signaled that they had reached the bottom. Here below, it was much warmer than on the wintry plain. The miner walked very fast, and trying to keep up for fear of losing him in the darkness, Bastian was soon covered with sweat. They twined their way over endless passages and galleries, which sometimes opened out into spacious vaults, as Bastian could tell by the echo of their footfalls. Several times Bastian bruised himself against jutting stones or wooden props, but Yor took no notice. On this first day, and for several that followed, the miner, by wordlessly guiding Bastian's hand, instructed him in the art of separating the paper-thin leaves of isinglass from one another and picking them up. There were tools for the purpose. They felt like wooden or horn spatulas, but Bastian never saw them. For when the day's work was done, they stayed down in the mine. Little by little, he learned to find his way in the darkness. A new sense that he could not have accounted for taught him to distinguish one gallery from another. One day, Yor told him silently, with the mere touch of his hands, to work alone in a low gallery, which he could enter only by crawling. Bastian obeyed. It was very close and cramped, and above him lay a mountain of stone. Curled up like an unborn child in its mother's womb, he lay in the dark depths of Fantastica's foundations, patiently digging for a forgotten dream, a picture that might lead him to the water of life. Since he could see nothing in the eternal night of the mine, he could not choose or come to any decision. He could only hope that chance or a merciful fate would eventually lead him to a lucky find. Evening after evening, he brought what he had managed to gather from the Minrud mine into the failing daylight. And evening after evening, his work had been in vain. But Bastian did not complain or rebel. He had lost all self-pity. Though his strength was inexhaustible, he often felt tired. How long this painful work went on is hard to say, for such labor cannot be measured in days and months. Be that as it may, one evening he brought to the surface a picture. It moved him so deeply the moment he looked at it that he needed all his self-control to keep from letting out a cry of surprise that would have crumbled the picture to dust. On the fragile sheet of isinglass, it was not very large, about the size of a usual book page, he saw a man wearing a white smock and holding a plaster cast in one hand. His posture and the troubled look on his face touched Bastian to the heart. What stirred him the most was that the man was shut up in a transparent but impenetrable block of ice. While Bastian looked at the picture that lay before him in the snow, a longing grew in him for this man whom he did not know. A surge of feeling that seemed to come from far away. Like a tidal wave, almost imperceptible at first, it gradually built up strength till it submerged everything in its path. Bastian struggled for air. His heart pounded. It was not big enough for so great a longing. That surge of feeling submerged everything that he still remembered of himself. And he forgot the last thing he still possessed, his own name. Later on, when he joined Yor in the hut, he was silent. The miner was silent too, but for a long while he faced Bastian, his eyes once again seeming to look through him and far into the distance. And for the first time since Bastian had come, a smile passed briefly over the miner's stone-gray features. That night, tired as he was, the boy who no longer had a name could not sleep. He kept seeing the picture before his eyes. It was as though this man wanted to say something to him, but could not, because of the block of ice he was imprisoned in. The boy without a name wanted to help him, wanted to make the ice melt. As in a waking dream, he saw himself hugging the block of ice, trying in vain to melt it with the heat of his body. But then, all at once, he heard what the man was trying to say to him. He heard it not with his ears, but deep in his heart. "Please, help me! Don't leave me! I can't get out of this ice alone! Help me! Only you can help me!" When they awoke next morning at daybreak, the boy without a name said to Yor, "I won't be going down into the mine with you any more."
"Are you going to leave me?"
The boy nodded.
"I'm going to look for the water of life."
"Have you found the picture that will guide you?"
"Yes."
"Will you show it to me?" Again the boy nodded. They went out into the snow where the picture lay. The boy looked at it, but Yor directed his blind eyes at the boy's face, as though looking through it into the distance. For a long while he seemed to be listening for some sound. At length he nodded.
"Take it with you," he whispered, "and don't lose it. If you lose it, or if it is destroyed, you will have nothing left in Fantastica. You know what that means."
The boy, who no longer had a name, stood with bowed head and was silent for a while. Then he said, just as softly,
"Thank you, Yor, for what you have taught me."
They pressed each other's hands.
"You've been a good miner," Yor whispered. "You've worked well."
Then he turned away and went to the mineshaft. Without turning around, he got into the pit cage and descended into the depths. The boy without a name picked the picture out of the snow and plodded out into the snow-covered plain. He had been walking for many hours. Yor's hut had long since disappeared below the horizon. On all sides there was nothing to be seen but the endless snow-covered plain. But he felt that the picture, which he was holding carefully in both hands, was pulling him in a certain direction. Regardless of how far it might be, he was determined to follow this pull, for he was convinced that it would take him to the right place. Nothing must hold him back. He felt sure of finding the water of life. Suddenly he heard a clamor in the air, as though innumerable creatures were screaming and twittering. Looking up into the sky, he saw a dark cloud, like a great flock of birds. But when the flock came closer, he saw what it really was, and terror stopped him in his tracks. It was the butterfly clowns, the Schlamoofs.
"Merciful heavens," thought the boy without a name, "if only they haven't seen me. They'll shatter the picture with their screams."
But they had seen him. Laughing and rollicking, they shot down and landed all around him in the snow.
"Hurrah!" they croaked, opening wide their motley-coloured mouths. "At last we've found him, our great benefactor!"
They tumbled in the snow, threw snowballs at one another, turned somersaults, and stood on their heads.
"Be still, please be still,"
the boy without a name whispered in desperation. The whole chorus screamed with enthusiasm.
"What did he say? He said we were too still. Nobody ever told us that before."
"What do you want of me?" asked the boy. "Why won't you leave me alone?"
All whirled around him, cackling.
"Great benefactor! Great benefactor! Do you remember how you saved us when we were the Akaris? Then we were the unhappiest creatures in all Fantastica. But now we're fed up with ourselves. At first what you did to us was a lot of fun. But now we're bored to death. We flit and we flutter, and we don't know where we're at. We can't even play any decent games, because we haven't any rules. You've turned us into preposterous clowns, that's what you've done. You've cheated us."
"I meant well," said the horrified boy.
"Sure, you meant well by yourself,"
the Schlamoofs shouted in chorus.
Your kindness made you feel great, didn't it? But we paid the bill for your kindness, you great benefactor.
What should I do? The boy asked. What do you want of me?
We've been looking for you,
screamed the Schlamoofs with grimacing clown faces.
We wanted to catch you before you could make yourself scarce. Now we've caught you, and we won't leave you in peace until you become our chief. We want you to be our head Schlamoof, our master Schlamoof, our general Schlamoof, you name it.
But why? The boy asked imploringly. The chorus of clowns screamed back.
We want you to give us orders. We want you to order us around, to make us do something, to forbid us to do something. We want you to give us an aim in life.
I can't do that. Why don't you elect one of your number?
No, we want you. You made us what we are.
No, the boy panted. I have to go. I have to go back.
Not so fast, great benefactor,
cried the butterfly clowns.
You can't get away from us. You think you can sneak away from Fantastica, don't you? You'd like that, wouldn't you?
But I'm at the end of my rope, the boy protested.
What about us?
The chorus replied. Go away, cried the boy. I can't bother with you any more.
Then you must turn us back, cried the shrill voices. Then we'd rather be Akaris. The Lake of Tears has dried up. Amaganth is on dry land now. And no one spins fine silver filigree any more. We want to be Akaris again.
I can't, the boy replied. I no longer have any power in Fantastica.
In that case,
the whole swarm bellowed, whirling and swirling about,
we'll kidnap you.
Hundreds of little hands seized him and tried to lift him off the ground. The boy struggled with might and main, and the butterflies were tossed in all directions. But like angry wasps, they kept coming back. Suddenly, in the midst of this hubbub, a low yet powerful sound was heard. Something like the booming of a bronze bell. In a twinkling, the Schlamoofs took flight, and their cloud soon vanished in the sky. The boy who had no name knelt in the snow. Before him, crumbled into dust, lay the picture. Now all was lost. Now nothing could lead him to the water of life. When he looked up, he saw, blurred by his tears, two forms in the snow. One was large, the other small. He wiped his eyes and took another look. The two forms were Falcor the White Luck Dragon and Atreyu. 26. The Water of Life. Zigzagging unsteadily, scarcely able to control his feet, the boy who had no name took a few steps toward Atreyu. Then he stopped. Atreyu did nothing, but watched him closely. The wound in his chest was no longer bleeding. For a long while they faced each other. Neither said a word. It was so still they could hear each other's breathing. Slowly, the boy without a name reached for the gold chain around his neck and divested himself of Orin. He bent down and carefully laid the gem in the snow before Atreyu. As he did so, he took another look at the two snakes, the one light, the other dark, which were biting each other's tail and formed an oval. Then he let the amulet go. In that moment, Orin, the golden gem, became so bright, so radiant, that he had to close his eyes as though dazzled by the sun. When he opened them again, he saw that he was in a vaulted building, as large as the vault of the sky. It was built from blocks of golden light, and in the middle of this immeasurable space lay, as big as the ramparts of a town, the two snakes. Atreyu, Falcor, and the boy without a name stood side by side near the head of the black snake, which held the white snake's tail in its jaws. The rigid eye, with its vertical pupil, was directed at the three of them. Compared to that eye, they were tiny. Even the luck dragon seemed no larger than a white caterpillar. The motionless bodies of the snakes glistened like some unknown metal, the one black as night, the other silvery white. The havoc they could wreak was checked only because they held each other prisoner. If they let each other go, the world would end. That was certain. But while holding each other fast, they guarded the water of life. For in the center of the edifice they encircled, there was a great fountain. Its beam danced up and down, and in falling, created and dispersed thousands of forms far more quickly than the eye could follow. The foaming water burst into a fine mist in which the golden light was refracted with all the colors of the rainbow. The fountain roared and laughed and rejoiced with a thousand voices. As though parched with thirst, the boy without a name looked at the water. But how was he to reach it? The snake's head did not move. Then Falcor raised his head. His ruby-red eyeballs glittered.
"Do you understand what the water is saying?" he asked.
"No," said Atreyu, "I don't."
"I don't know why," said Falcor, "but I understand perfectly. Maybe because I'm a luck dragon. All the languages of joy are related."
"What does the water say?" Atreyu asked. Falcor listened closely, and slowly repeated what he heard.
"I am the water of life. Out of myself I grow. The more you drink of me, the fuller I will flow."
Again he listened a while. Then he said,
"It keeps saying, 'Drink, drink, do what you wish.'"
"How can we get to it?" Atreyu asked.
"It's asking us our names," Falcor reported.
"I'm Atreyu," Atreyu cried.
"I'm Falcor," cried Falcor.
The boy without a name was silent. Atreyu looked at him, then took him by the hand and cried, "He's Bastian Balthazar Books!"
"It asks," Falcor translated, "why he doesn't speak for himself."
"He can't," said Atreyu. "He has forgotten everything."
Falcor listened again to the roaring of the fountain. "Without memory," it says, "he cannot come in. The snakes won't let him through."
Atreyu replied, "I have stored up everything he told us about himself and his world. I vouch for him." Falcor listened.
"It wants to know by what right."
"I am his friend," said Atreyu. Again Falcor listened attentively.
"That may not be acceptable," he whispered to Atreyu. "Now it's speaking of your wound. It wants to know how that came about."
"We were both right," said Atreyu, "and we were both wrong. But now Bastian has given up Orin of his own free will." Falcor listened and nodded.
"Yes," he said, "it accepts that. This place is Orin. We are welcome," it says.
Atreyu looked up at the enormous golden dome. "Each of us," he whispered, "has worn it around his neck. You too, Falcor, for a while." The luck dragon motioned him to be still and listened again to the sound of the water. Then he translated,
"Orin is the door that Bastian has been looking for. He carried it with him from the start. But, it says, the snakes won't let anything belonging to Fantastica cross the threshold. Bastian must therefore give up everything the childlike emperors gave him. Otherwise he cannot drink of the water of life."
"But we are in her sign," cried Atreyu. "Isn't she herself here?"
"It says that Moonchild's power ends here. She is the only one who can never set foot in this place. She cannot penetrate to the center of Orin, because she cannot cast off her own self. Atreyu was too bewildered to speak. "Now," said Falcor, "it's asking whether Bastion is ready." At that moment, the enormous black snake's head began to move very slowly, though without releasing the white snake's tail. The gigantic bodies arched until they formed a gate, one half of which was black and the other white. Atreyu took Bastion by the hand and led him through the terrible gate toward the fountain, which now lay before them in all its grandeur. Falcor followed. As they advanced, one after another of Bastion's fantastican gifts fell away from him. The strong, handsome, fearless hero became again the small, fat, timid boy. Even his clothing, which had been reduced almost to rags in the Minrud mine, vanished and dissolved into nothingness. In the end, he stood naked before the great golden bowl, at the center of which the water of life leapt high into the air like a crystal tree. In this last moment, when he no longer possessed any of the fantastican gifts, but had not yet recovered his memory of his own world and himself, he was in a state of utter uncertainty, not knowing which world he belonged to, or whether he really existed. But then he jumped into the crystal clear water. He splashed and spluttered and let the sparkling rain fall into his mouth. He drank till his thirst was quenched, and joy filled him from head to foot, the joy of living and the joy of being himself. He was newborn, and the best part of it was that he was now the very person he wanted to be. If he had been free to choose, he would have chosen to be no one else, because now he knew that there were thousands and thousands of forms of joy in the world, but that all were essentially one and the same, namely, the joy of being able to love. And much later, long after Bastion had returned to his world, in his maturity and even in his old age, this joy never left him entirely. Even in the hardest moments of his life, he preserved a light-heartedness that made him smile and that comforted others. "Atreyu!" he cried out to his friend, who was standing with Falcor at the edge of the great golden bowl. "Come on in! Come and drink! It's wonderful!" Atreyu laughed and shook his head. "No," he called back. "This time we're only here to keep you company." "This time?" Bastion asked. "What do you mean by that?" Atreyu exchanged a glance with Falcor. Then he said, "Falcor and I have already been here. We didn't recognize the place at first because we were asleep when we were brought here and when we were taken away. But now we remember." Bastion came out of the water. "Now I know who I am," he said, beaming. "Yes," said Atreyu, and nodded. "And now I recognize you. Now you look the way you did when I saw you in the magic mirror gate." Bastion looked up at the foaming, sparkling water. "I'd like to bring my father some," he shouted. "But how?" "I don't think you can do that," said Atreyu. "It's not possible to carry anything from Fantastica across the threshold."
"For Bastion, it is," said Falcor, whose voice had resumed its full bronze resonance. "He can do it."
"You really are a luck dragon," said Bastion. Falcor motioned him to be still while he listened to the roaring voice of the water. Then he said,
"The water says you must be on your way now. And so must we."
"Which is my way?" Bastion asked.
"Out through the other gate," Falcor answered, "where the white snake's head is lying."
"All right," said Bastion. "But how will I get out? The white head isn't moving."
Indeed, the white snake's head lay motionless. It held the black snake's tail in its jaws, and stared at Bastion out of its great eyes. "The water asks you," Falcor translated, "whether you completed all the stories you began in Fantastica."
"No," said Bastion, "none of them really."
Falcor listened a while. His face took on a worried look. "In that case, it says, the White Snake won't let you through. You must go back to Fantastica and finish them all."
"All the stories?" Bastion stammered. "Then I'll never be able to go back. Then it's all been for nothing."
Falcor listened eagerly.
"What does it say?"
Bastion wanted to know. "Hush," said Falcor. After a while, he sighed and said, "It says there's no help for it unless someone promises to do it in your place. But no one can do that."
"I can. I will," said Atreyu.
Bastion looked at him in silence. Then he fell on his neck and stammered,
"Atreyu, Atreyu, I'll never forget this."
Atreyu smiled.
"That's good, Bastion. Then you won't forget Fantastica either."
He gave him a brotherly pat on the back, then quickly turned around and headed for the Black Snake's gate, which was still upraised and open as when they had entered.
"Falcor," said Bastion, "how will you and Atreyu finish the stories I have left behind?"
The White Dragon winked one of his ruby-red eyes and replied, "With luck, my boy, with luck." Then he followed his friend and master. Bastion watched as they passed through the gate on their way back to Fantastica. They turned again and waved to him. Then as the Black Snake's head sank to the ground, Atreyu and Falcor vanished from Bastion's sight. Now he was alone. He turned toward the White Snake's head. It had risen, and the snake's body now formed a gate, just as the Black Snake's body had done. Quickly, Bastion cupped his hands, gathered as much of the water of life as he could hold, ran to the gate, and flung himself into the empty darkness beyond.
"Father!" he screamed. "Father! I am Bastion Balthazar Books! Father! Father! I am Bastion Balthazar Books!"
Still screaming, he found himself in the schoolhouse attic, which long, long ago he had left for Fantastica. At first he didn't recognize the place, and because of the strange objects around him, the stuffed animals, the skeleton and the paintings, he thought for a brief moment that this might be a different part of Fantastica. But then, catching sight of his school satchel and the rusty seven-armed candelabrum with the spent candles, he knew where he was. How long could it have been since he started on his long journey through the never-ending story? Weeks? Months? Years? He had once read about a man who had just spent an hour in a magic cave. When he returned home, 100 years had passed, and of all the people he had known as a child, he remembered only one, and he was an old man. Bastion was aware of the grey daylight, but he could not make out whether it was morning or afternoon. It was bitter cold in the attic, just as on the night of Bastion's departure. He disentangled himself from the dusty army blankets, put on his shoes and coat, and saw to his surprise that they were wet as they had been the day when it had rained so hard. He looked for the book he had stolen that day, the book that had started him on his adventure. He was determined to bring it back to that grumpy Mr. Coriander. What did he care if Mr. Coriander punished him for stealing it or reported him to the police? A person who had ridden on the back of the many-colored death didn't scare so easily. But the book wasn't there. Bastion looked and looked. He rummaged through the blankets and looked in every corner. Without success. The never-ending story had disappeared. "Oh well," Bastion finally said to himself,
I'll have to tell him it's gone. Of course he won't believe me. There's nothing I can do about that. I'll just have to take the consequences. But maybe he won't even remember the book after all this time. Maybe the bookshop isn't even there anymore. He would soon find out how much time had elapsed. If when he passed through the schoolhouse, the teachers and pupils he ran into were unknown to him, he would know what to expect. But when he opened the attic door and went down the stairs, there wasn't a sound to be heard. The building seemed deserted. Then the school clock struck 9. That meant it was morning, so classes must have begun. Bastian looked into several classrooms. All were empty. When he went to a window and looked down into the street, he saw a few pedestrians and cars. So the world hadn't come to an end. He ran down the steps and tried to open the big front door, but it was locked. He went to the janitor's office, rang the bell and knocked, but no one stirred. What was he to do? He couldn't just wait for someone to turn up. Even if he had spilled the water of life, he wanted to go home to his father. Should he open a window and shout until somebody heard him and had the door opened? No, that would make him feel foolish. It occurred to him that he could climb out of a window, since the windows could be opened from the inside. But the ground floor windows were all barred. Then he remembered that in looking out of the second floor window, he had seen some scaffolding. Evidently the facade was being refurbished. Bastian went back up to the second floor and opened the window. The scaffolding consisted only of uprights, with boards placed horizontally between them at intervals. He stepped out on the top board, which swayed under his weight. For a moment his head reeled and he felt afraid, but he fought his dizziness and fear. To someone who had been Lord of Perilin, this was no problem. Even if he had lost all his fabulous strength, and even though the weight of his little fat body was making things rather hard for him. Calmly and deliberately, he found holds for his hands and feet, and climbed down. Once he got a splinter in his hand, but such trifles meant nothing to him now. Though slightly overheated and out of breath, he reached the street in good shape. No one had seen him. Bastian ran home. He ran so hard that the books and pens in his satchel jiggled and rattled to the rhythm of his steps. He had a stitch in his side, but in his hurry to see his father, he kept on running. When at last he came to the house where he lived, he stopped for a moment and looked up at the window of his father's laboratory. Then suddenly he was seized with fear. For the first time it occurred to him that his father might not be there any more. But his father was there and must have seen him coming, for when Bastian rushed up the stairs, his father came running to meet him. He spread out his arms and Bastian threw himself into them. His father lifted him up and carried him inside. "Bastian, my boy," he said over and over again. "My dear little boy, where have you been? What happened to you?" A few minutes later, they were sitting at the kitchen table, and Bastian was drinking hot milk and eating breakfast rolls, which his father had lovingly spread with butter and honey. Then the boy noticed that his father's face was pale and drawn, his eyes red, and his chin unshaven. But otherwise he looked the same as he had long ago, when Bastian went away, and Bastian told him so.
"Long ago?" his father asked in amazement. "What do you mean?
How long have I been gone?"
"Since yesterday, Bastian, since you went to school. But when you didn't come home, I phoned your teachers, and they told me you hadn't been there. I looked for you all day and all night, my boy. I feared the worst. I put the police on your trail."
"Oh, God, Bastian, what happened? I've been half crazy with worry. Where have you been?"
Then Bastian began to tell his father about his adventures. He told the whole story in great detail. It took many hours. His father listened as he had never listened before. He understood Bastian's story. At about midday, he interrupted Bastian for a little while.
First he called the police to tell them that his son had come home and that everything was all right. Then he made lunch for both of them, and Bastian went on with his story. Night was falling by the time Bastian came to the Water of Life and told his father how he had wanted to bring some home, but had spilled it. It was almost dark in the kitchen. His father sat motionless. Bastian stood up and switched on the light. And then he saw something he had never seen before. He saw tears in his father's eyes. And he knew that he had brought him the Water of Life after all. Bastian's father sat him down on his lap and hugged him. When they had sat like that for a long while, his father heaved a deep sigh, looked into Bastian's face, and smiled. It was the happiest smile Bastian had ever seen on his face. "From now on," said his father, "everything is going to be different between us. Don't you agree?" Bastian nodded. He couldn't speak. His heart was too full. Next morning, the winter's first snow lay soft and clean on Bastian's windowsill. The street sounds that came to him were muffled. "Do you know what, Bastian?" said his father at breakfast. "I think we two have every reason to celebrate. A day like this happens only once in a lifetime, and some people never have one. So I suggest that we do something really sensational. I'll forget about my work, and you needn't go to school. I'll write an excuse for you. How does that sound?" "School?" said Bastian. "Is it still operating? When I passed through the building yesterday, there wasn't a soul. Not even the janitor was there." "Yesterday?" said his father. "Yesterday was Sunday." Bastian stirred his cocoa thoughtfully. Then he said in an undertone, "I think it's going to take me a little while to get used to things again." "Exactly," said his father. "And that's why we're giving ourselves a little holiday. What would you like to do? We could go for a hike in the country, or we could go to the zoo. Either way, we'll treat ourselves to the finest lunch the world has ever seen. This afternoon we could go shopping and buy anything you like. And tonight, how about the theatre?" Bastian's eyes sparkled. Then he said firmly, "Wonderful. But there's something I must do first. I have to go and tell Mr. Coriander that I stole his book and lost it." Bastian's father took his hand. "If you like," he said, "I'll attend to that for you." "No," said Bastian, "it's my responsibility. I want to do it myself, and I think I should do it right away." He stood up and put on his coat. His father said nothing, but the look on his face was one of surprise and respect. Such behavior in Bastian was something new. "I believe," he said finally, "that I too will need a little time to get used to things." Bastian was already in the entrance hall. "I'll be right back," he called. "I'm sure it won't take long. Not this time." When he came to Mr. Coriander's bookshop, his courage failed him after all. He looked through the pane with the ornate lettering on it. Mr. Coriander was busy with a customer, and Bastian decided to wait. He walked up and down outside the shop. It was snowing again. At last, the customer left. "Now," Bastian commanded himself. Remembering how he had gone to meet Grogramarn in Goab, the Desert of Colors, he pressed the door handle resolutely. Behind the wall of books at the far end of the dimly lit room, he heard a cough. He went forward. Then, slightly pale, but with grave composure, he stepped up to Mr. Coriander, who was sitting in his worn leather armchair as he had been at their last meeting. For a long time, Bastian said nothing. He had expected Mr. Coriander to go red in the face and scream at him, "Thief! Monster!" or something of the kind. Instead, the old man deliberately lit his curved pipe, screwed up his eyes, and studied the boy through his ridiculous little spectacles. When the pipe was finally burning, he puffed a while, then grumbled,
"Well, what is it this time?"
"I..." Bastian began haltingly. "I stole a book from you. I meant to return it, but I can't, because I lost it. Or rather, well, I haven't got it any more."
Mr. Coriander stopped puffing and took his pipe out of his mouth.
"What sort of book?" he asked.
"The one you were reading the last time I was here. I walked off with it. You were telephoning in the back room. It was lying on the chair. And I just walked off with it."
"I see," said Mr. Coriander, clearing his throat. "But none of my books is missing. What was the title of this book?"
"It's called The Never-Ending Story," said Bastian. "It's bound in copper-coloured silk that shimmers when you move it around. There are two snakes on the cover, a light one and a dark one, and they're biting each other's tail. Inside it's printed in two different colours, and there are big, beautiful capitals at the beginning of the chapters."
"This is extremely odd," said Mr. Coriander. "I've never had such a book. You can't have stolen it from me. Maybe you swiped it somewhere else."
"Oh, no," Bastian assured him. "You must remember. It's..." He hesitated, but then he blurted it out. "It's a magic book. While I was reading it, I got into the never-ending story, and when I came out again, the book was gone."
Mr. Coriander watched Bastian over his spectacles.
"Would you be pulling my leg by any chance?"
"No," said Bastian in dismay. "Of course not. I'm telling you the truth. You must know that."
Mr. Coriander thought for a while, then shook his head.
"Better tell me all about it. Sit down, boy. Make yourself at home."
He pointed his pipe stem at a second armchair facing his own, and Bastian sat down.
"And now," said Mr. Coriander, "tell me the whole story. But slowly, if you please, and one thing at a time."
And Bastian told his story. He told it a little more briefly than he had to his father, but since Mr. Coriander listened with keen interest and kept asking for details, it was more than 2 hours before Bastian had done. Heaven knows why, but in all that long time they were not disturbed by a single customer. When Bastian had finished, Mr. Coriander puffed for a long while, as though deep in thought. At length he cleared his throat, straightened his little spectacles, looked Bastian over, and said,
"One thing is sure. You didn't steal this book from me, because it belongs neither to me nor to you nor to anyone else. If I'm not mistaken, the book itself comes from Fantastica. Maybe at this very moment, who knows, someone else is reading it."
"Then you believe me?" Bastian asked.
"Of course I believe you," said Mr. Coriander. "Any sensible person would."
"Frankly," said Bastian, "I didn't expect you to."
"There are people who can never go to Fantastica," said Mr. Coriander, "and others who can, but who stay there forever. And there are just a few who go to Fantastica and come back. Like you. And they make both worlds well again."
"Oh," said Bastian, blushing slightly, "I don't deserve any credit. I almost didn't make it back. If it hadn't been for Atreyu, I'd have been stuck in the city of old emperors for good."
Mr. Coriander nodded and puffed at his pipe.
He grumbled. "You're lucky having a friend in Fantastica. God knows it's not everybody who can say that."
"Mr. Coriander," Bastian asked, "how do you know all that? I mean, have you ever been in Fantastica?"
"Of course I have,"
said Mr. Coriander.
"But then," said Bastian, "you must know Moonchild."
"Yes, I know the childlike empress," said Mr. Coriander, "though not by that name. I called her something different. But that doesn't matter."
"Then you must know the book,"
Bastian cried. Then you have read the never-ending story. Mr. Coriander shook his head.
Every real story is a never-ending story.
He passed his eyes over the many books that covered the walls of his shop from floor to ceiling, pointed the stem of his pipe at them, and went on.
There are many doors to Fantastica, my boy. There are other such magic books. A lot of people read them without noticing. It all depends on who gets his hands on such books.
Then the never-ending story is different for different people.
That's right, said Mr. Coriander. And besides, it's not just books. There are other ways of getting to Fantastica and back. You'll find out.
Do you think so? Bastian asked, hopefully. But then I'd have to meet Moonchild again, and no one can meet her more than once. Mr. Coriander leaned forward and lowered his voice.
Let an old Fantastica hand tell you something, my boy. This is a secret that no one in Fantastica can know. When you think it over, you'll see why. You can't visit Moonchild a second time, that's true. But if you can give her a new name, you'll see her again. And however often you manage to do that, it will be the first and only time.
For a moment, Mr. Coriander's bulldog face took on a soft glow, which made it look young and almost handsome. Thank you, Mr. Coriander, said Bastian.
I have to thank you, my boy, said Mr. Coriander. I'd appreciate it if you dropped in to see me now and then. We could exchange experiences. There aren't many people one can discuss these things with.
He held out his hand to Bastian.
Will you?
Gladly, said Bastian, taking the proffered hand. I have to go now. My father's waiting. But I'll come and see you soon.
Mr. Coriander took him to the door. Through the reversed writing on the glass pane, Bastian saw that his father was waiting for him across the street. His face was one great beam. Bastian opened the door so vigorously that the little glass bells tinkled wildly and ran across to his father. Mr. Coriander closed the door gently and looked after father and son.
Bastian Balthazar books, he grumbled. If I'm not mistaken, you will show many others the way to Fantastica, and they will bring us the water of life.
Mr. Coriander was not mistaken. But that's another story, and shall be told another time.
This concludes the never-ending story. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.